instead of trying to find out what you can make more money of, what you can get more honors from, you try to do things that you think are more important. That may not be completely rational. A part of it is possibly just plain craziness.
He's very funny, and he's deadly serious. He's extremely knowledgeable in all kinds of advanced fields, but he walks down the street like a little boy as if he's seeing the thing for the first time.
Anyone who can translate the Babylonian Talmud into modern Hebrew and comment on it, and then go on to do it in English and in Russian and French, has done such a good deed for Jews and people all over the earth, Jewish and non-Jewish, that alone would make him a giant.
He works from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock at night, usually.
Yeah.
He drinks coffee and he eats chocolate.
Box.
He doesn't need to sleep. And he says, if I sleep, then I'm going to get used to it. So I don't want that. I always have to be on edge.
Rabbi Steinsaltz is either challenging us intellectually or he's trying to make us laugh.
A person once approached us at a dinner table and asked the rabbi, you know, very, very excitedly, Rabbi, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, has died a couple of months ago, and I understand that you're supposed to take over as the new Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the rabbi looked at him with a straight face, and he said to him, that happens to be true, but only after I finish my tenure as the King of Poland.
Every story that he tells, every answer to every question that he gives, starts like rolling off in some direction. We say, where is this guy going? It always manages to come back full circle and tie a neat bow. And you say, wow.
My Senate colleague, Pat Moynihan, had referred to Rabbi Steinsaltz famously now as a once-in-a-millennium scholar.
I considered him actually the greatest of all living scholars, Jewish scholars.
This is a leader that can connect to the spirit in each and every human being. And in a way, I think that is exactly what speaks to me the most about Rabbi Steinsaltz, that he doesn't just connect to your mind. He doesn't just connect to your heart. He connects to your very essence.
There's a joy about him that as I said earlier, is actually physical. His eyes are aflame.
The combination of the mind and the insight and the knowledge, the lack of pretentiousness, the humor, the ability to connect to people, and just the ability to be an ordinary, down-to-earth human being. That combination you find once, you know, every few million people.
My soul clicked with his when he spoke.
He's the cutest, smartest person I know.
His teachings have guided my life.
He has something special, and he's generous in sharing it.
Dan? Fine. Okay, so. Thank you. Okay, so fun.
Hello, hello.
Dan, sorry about that. I realized I was muted. I watched that video, which I sent out to you. So just watch that video and you'll catch up. But I'm just going to talk about, tonight we're talking about Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz. The title class is Let My People Know. So that was just the thing. All right, so without further ado, I'm going to bring up the sheet. Dan, can you see me?
I can see you.
All right, you're outside. All right, so how about, all right, so you want, can you read the sheet? Because everybody can hear you because you're through the TV.
Okay, I can see the sheet now.
Good. You want to read it out for everybody?
Rabbi Adin Stanislas is a teacher, philosopher.
Steinsaltz. Okay,
good. Rabbi Steinsaltz is a teacher, philosopher, social critic, and prolific author who has been hailed by Time magazine as a once-in-a-millennium scholar. His lifelong work in Jewish education earned him the Israel Prize, his country's highest honor. Born in Yerushalayim in 1937 to secular parents who immigrated to Palestine in 1924, Rabbi Steinsaltz, did you write that time?
Yeah, we're going to go with that. Okay.
Studied mathematics, physics, and chemistry at Hebrew U in addition to rabbinical studies. He established several experimental schools and at age 24 became Israel's youngest school principal. His favorite slogan was, "Let my people know." And he spent his life making Jewish texts accessible. In 1965, Rabbi Steinsaltz founded the Israel Institute for Talmudic Publications and began his epic modern Hebrew translation and commentary on the Talmud. It took 45 years, but he completed all 63 volumes, and the work was also translated into English, French, Russian, and Spanish. The Talmud is a central pillar of Jewish knowledge, important for the overall understanding of what is Jewish. Steinsaltz told JTA in 2010 after completing the transition, "But it is a book that Jews cannot understand. This is a dangerous situation, like a collective amnesia. I try to make pathways through which people will be able to enter the Talmud without encountering possible barriers. It is something that will always be a challenge, but I tried to make it at least possible."
Okay. So in addition to writing, translating the entire Babylonian Talmud, he also and his team wrote commentary, which actually I use on a regular basis, on the entire Mishneh Torah, and also came out a translation of the entire Tanakh, which was first, he wrote in Hebrew, and then it was since translated into English. So his version is a fantastic version. It's a beautiful, beautiful edition. So when he passed away, and he also translated the Jerusalem Talmud. One guy. And his team, but the Talmud, he basically did himself. I mean, this is remarkable. And I start off with, caught in the bio, let me talk a little bit about his parents. His dad wasn't just secular. He was a communist. He was so much of a committed communist that he went to fight on the communist side in Spain against Franco. Okay, this is before 1937, 1938. He came back to Israel. Although he comes from a rabbinic stock, his father, he was a communist, secular Zionist. Okay, and out comes Adin. Now, his father had an interesting point. He says, "I'm going to send you to a Jewish school. Why would a communist who officially doesn't believe in God send his child to a Jewish school?" But he gave a reason. He gave a reason. I'm just trying to see if you can guess it. Okay, that's a good answer. And I think that you can have support for that theory. He didn't give that reason. He says something very powerful. He says, "I just don't want you to be ignorant of Judaism and our texts." So a Jewish Zionist communist, even though that doesn't believe in the premises of Judaism, is not just a communist, but he's a Jewish communist. And even from his perspective, he recognized that this was, in other words, his father would agree that the Talmud is a central pillar of Jewish knowledge, important for understanding of what is Jewish. He just doesn't agree with that conclusion. But he felt, his father felt, that that to be ignorant of your past is not right. So that was not uncommon, nor is, you could be a secular Jew, but you can't be an ignorant secular Jew. That was, he felt, to be disgraceful. Or you got to know what you're rejecting. Okay? So now to just be secular and just be an ignoramus, that's not right. So he sent little Adin to school. And as you can figure out from his whole bio, he's a little bit on the genius side. Okay, so and he became a Baal Tshuva. The yeshiva that he sent to was affiliated with Lubavitch. Ultimately, and he connected to Lubavitch, I guess, you know, philosophy. He wrote an English book on Kabbalah called The 13 Petal Rose. I think it's in the MG library downstairs. It was one of his first books. I got it from my bar mitzvah in 1980. Could not understand it. Maybe I'll take another try now, but and I said, I don't know what this guy's talking about. Anyway, so my father just, you know, he first translated his first move was to translate the Talmud into conversational Hebrew. So basically, he always had a very broad perspective. It's for, as he said, let my people know. He wants the Jewish text not to be limited to a super small fragment of the Jewish people who can who can figure out the Aramaic text and make head and tails out of it. So he dedicated himself because he felt that the, you know, Judaism fundamentally is manifest in the, you know, the 2,700 pages of the Babylonian Talmud. It took him 45 years. He got a lot of pushback. He felt that's, you know, not to do it, not to make it so accessible. He said, I know you can check on Wikipedia at Dean Steinsaltz. You see, he had academics that were not happy with it. He had very yeshiva people on it. He didn't care. All right. So he's an independent kind of guy. He's not really fit in any kind of box, really. All right. So that's point one. So, and he left this world, gave the Jewish people and non-Jewish people a tremendous gift because he made the classic works of Judaism, the Talmud, the Tanakh, the Rambam, some, you know, and all this, and also not just English, but Spanish, Russian, French as well, available to a huge swath of people, basically everybody. We have copies of the English translation of the Steinsaltz. You'll see it downstairs. It's beautiful. They did a beautiful edition. So now I just want to focus in here. What did he study in university? Math, chemistry, and physics. Basically, he was like a chemistry. Now it's very funny. He's just like this science kind of nerd guy. But ironically, what he's spending most of his time is really articulating literature of different kinds. It's kind of, so it's very, very kind of interesting. And one of his greatest accomplishments, I mentioned about his parents. Now, here's a question what I want to get into. Why would a person raised by a communist father write a user-friendly commentary on both the Babylonian Talmud and the Tanakh used by Jew and non-Jew alike? Or why would...
Wanted to prove that, like, he wasn't his father?
He came home at one point. There's other videos. If you go onto the website, when he became religious, it hit him. It was more of a spontaneous experience for him personally. But he wasn't trying to show up his dad. That's interesting. For the elite. All right. So I don't know politically if he is. I don't think he personally ascribed to the communist manifesto. But you're saying that he just had a democratic perspective. Okay. Look. Unfortunately, he's not here to ask, and I don't have a video to bullet point. But I can't help but think that, in a certain sense, you know, he looked at his father and that generation. In a certain sense, you could argue he translated it really for them. In other words, because he wanted to make this you know, the wisdom of Judaism available to people who didn't go to yeshiva, and had no background, if you're a secular Israeli or now even an American, and you could read conventional English or Hebrew or Spanish or French or Russian, whatever your thing is, you can, with a basic thing, you will get a basic level sense of the very section of the Talmud, and he has introduction before, and it's very and his team does a beautiful job. It's great stuff. And his son, Mendy, is continuing on into sort of like to further add more works in their library, if you will, which has that very same very universal to share the wisdom of Judaism to everybody. And this is the Casawana. This is really sort of the focus of our class tonight: is what role does secular education play in helping them achieve these goals? What unique aspects of Steindl's works are explained by his family background? How did him getting his, studying these, math, science, physics, chemistry, and other secular subjects in Hebrew University help him achieve his goal? Okay, that's certainly true. That's true, but I think also it helped him to try to organize the material in a college-like organized fashion. In other words, when you go to university, graduate school, you are bombarded with information. You're writing papers. You're writing whatever you're doing. You have to take the information, organize it, recast it in a clear, understandable way. So basically, what do you take out of your book bag when you go to university about any subject matter? A textbook. So he's essentially creating modern textbooks, accessible, attractive. Like, for example, a textbook will have pictures, will be nice types. Same thing. It's basically he's creating modern Jewish textbooks. Because he's really speaking to the modern mind. He wants Judaism to be appreciated by the modern mind, because that's how as him being trained in that world, he sees all Jewish works in that way. So he's trying to translate, in other words, every translation is by definition an interpretation. So essentially what he did was trying to articulate what he saw. He saw these various bodies of work in a certain way. He recast it in sort of a modern, with his modern sensibilities, being a university trained person, and knowing, as Daphne pointed out, what could the modern person, how could you speak to such a person? Now, going personal, throughout the 70s and 80s, he would have he would have lectures, which included Levi Eshel, former Prime Minister of Israel, who would discuss various ideas. He would have these special, by invitation only, lectures. In addition to, he ran schools. He started two yeshivot. Guy is prolific in many ways. He was sent by the Rebbe to go to Russia when Russia opened up after the Cold War was over. He started a yeshiva. And I think possibly thousands of Russians viewed him as their Rebbe, as their exclusive teacher of Torah. The guy's like five, he's like 20 people. I mean, he's like, he's a little, so in a certain sense, he's not, so, as, Time Magazine says, the one in a millennium scholar. Okay, but I'm just trying to get into, I'm trying to distill what was he really trying to accomplish. He was essentially trying to accomplish how he saw Torah, articulate with a modern voice, a modern sensibility, to be able to create, in a certain sense, the textbooks which a new generation can gain access to, a world which is usually inaccessible unless you have tremendous amount of background knowledge. Okay? I mean, there was an English translation before the Steinsaltz. So just, does anyone know what that was? So the first translation of the Talmud into English was done by Sansino Press in England in 1937. But if you read it, it's not, it's just literally a translation. It's very hard to figure out. You have to know the Hebrew, you have to know really both. It's like it helps you, but you got to know what's going on the Aramaic side also. So it's not so good. Now, the Art Scroll came out in English was before Steinsaltz. They went right to English, and that's a pretty user-friendly edition. His first audience was Israel, and then translated to all these other dialects, English and French and Spanish and Russian. Okay, so the question is, how would you say that him being a Baal Tshuva, having communist parents, who, by the way, there's a story about his parents coming to his smicha, his chag smicha. So I don't know if you know. So just like graduation, you have a graduation party. So when you get ordained, so there's two components of how you get ordained. So there's A is the test. Old school, like I did when I got tested 31 years ago, it was an oral examination for 3 hours. Okay? That's how they used to do it also at university, typically with 3 rabbis. I had 1 rabbi, and it was just asking questions. And if you did a good job, you passed. So not written. In Israel, when they give ordination to a musmach from the rabbinate, it's a written test, okay? But I'm from a different generation, old school. So that's the testing part. Then there's the celebration part. You know, it's a big deal. So typically, your yeshiva will include you. Like YU has a Chag HaSmicha. They do it every 3 years. They bundle all the graduates that pass tests in the last 3 years, and they make one celebration. They have speeches, and there's a party, and there's music, and you know, there's food, obviously food. Okay. So my yeshiva had the annual dinner. So we were honored at the annual dinner. You know, that kind of thing. So it was a celebration kind of thing. So he had his parents come to his smicha event, his Chag HaSmicha. Now, so visualize super secular Israeli coming there to see their little Adin become Rabbi Adin. So apparently he says, you know, it was, you know, it's a little bit of a cultural thing, but bottom line, here's a question. Do you think they stepped nachas when they're Adin? Of course they did, because forget the communism and the Zionism, they're Jewish parents. When their kid, did a good job, they shed a little nachas. Okay, so of course, you know. Question is like this. Why do you think, how do you think, again, this is speculation on part, but I think it's helpful. How does the fact that he was a Baal Tshuva motivate and help him do this, these enormous monumental projects? Yes.
Is he thinking like maybe since it's like more digestible for more secular people, it'll like help other people who are secular like become more educated and like interested in Judaism?
Yes, but why would he want to do that?
Like because he did it himself, I guess. Like he went through it and like it was important for him, so he could like hopefully other people find value in that too.
Exactly. Since a person who has gone through, he went from raised secular, now more, you can't get more secular than being communist, because that means you do not believe in God, just those who are not up on their communism. And a communist Israeli, Zionist at that point in the 40s and early 50s, their new idea, we actually did this a couple senior fellowships ago. We actually had Max we had one of the other people be the, in the Knesset, the first Knesset in 1948, there was members of the Communist Party. They don't, you know, and they, their vision was that there's now a new Judaism. The Jewish communist who is building up, creating a communist state in Israel. That's why Russia, Soviet Russia, voted for accepting Israel at the UN, because they had big aspirations. We're going to have another communist state. This is going to be great. And the United States, because of many influences, but not the least of Harry Truman's former business partner, Jacobson, that first name of God, said you should, he recognized it 8 minutes, 10 minutes after it was recognized after they announced to themselves. So both only time during the Cold War that the United States and Russia voted in agreement on a major proposal in the UN. So both people were looking at Israel as being going to be the fulfillment of their political aspirations. So Adin Steinsaltz's father was from the communist side. So that was going to be the new Judaism. That was the idea. So therefore, I think what Shoshana's saying is very important, that if you grew up secular and you went through a whole journey, you're now observant and you experience Judaism as the joy of your life, it's natural you want other people to experience that. And you want people to make it easier for them to experience it. The fact that what he had to do was just to go from knowing very little to having to, start later in life to get an education and then go to yeshiva. And it's a lot of work. And he mastered all the stuff, which is a ridiculous amount of stuff. I'm not quite sure how one guy did this. It's a little boggles of mine. That's one part. He wants other people to share with others. And he has a tremendous identification and a sensitivity to people who, like himself, were not born into it. So you have a greater concern and empathy for a person who's like FFV is not naturally sensitive to the people who are living in the secular Jewish community, because they're living their little bubble. When you grow up, just to give you a sense, if you grow up from birth, like myself, So you live in a Jewish enclave. It could be Teaneck, it could be the Five Town, it could be even the Upper West Side. And there's so much Jewish happening, you don't realize that just like 5 inches away outside that little bubble is 95% of American Jews who are essentially unaffiliated. Okay, 95%. So when you're in the Jewish bubble, you think, well, everybody's like this, right? You're living in this unreal world, like, there's pizza shops, there's Saba's Pizza, and then we can go over and pizza kosher. You think you're in the, just imagine that everything is like that. But no, when you get out of that bubble, you become like, yeah, we're not paying attention to 95% of American Jewry who is unaffiliated. So therefore you're not naturally sensitive to that because you're living in a little surreal world, little bubble. I'm not saying not against the bubble, but there's a drawback to the bubble because your sense of what is the state of affairs in the Jewish community is completely distorted. And you might know it intellectually, mathematically, but you don't feel it. If you're a Baal Tshuva, you feel it because you call up your parents. All right, you know what's going on, okay? Your sister is going to be marrying a non-Jew. All right, you feel it. You know what's going on. So I think all of these things propelled them to do the Herculean task of providing, basically creating these textbooks, user-friendly, very attractive, affordable, the Talmud, the Mishneh Torah, and the Tanakh, which, by the way, I encourage you to get any one of those things, the Tanakh, if you want to get, I would first start with this Tanakh, very readable, and one of the good qualities is that when you have a translation, like Rabbi Kaplan, one of the ones I always use for my Parsha class, and here is Rabbi Kaplan, blessed memory. He also died very young. Also Baal Tshuva, again, showing a trait. He wrote 30 books, 40 books. Anybody who has read a book from Rabbi Ari Kaplan? Yeah. So he's tremendously prolific during his extremely short life. But again, he started his Jewish journey at like age 21. And I think he died when he was 42. He died young, and he was just, they cranked out a whole bunch of things. One of his great works is he wrote a translation of the Chumash, which I find is the most readable one. But he was forced, and he has notes, like, you have to like take a stand. There are words that you can, which you can have different shades, and Rashi will read it slightly this way, and the Ramban will write it this way. So you have to like sort of take a stand. And Rabbi Steinsaltz, you read it, his perspective, he as the translator disappears. I don't know if that means, or you don't feel like you're here. It's so well done that you're not sensing an agenda or a separate voice. Okay. For example, the stone Chumash in the beginning, full disclosure, says we are translating this entire Chumash based upon the perspective of Rashi. So the old so every translation, I'll give you a simple example. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim. And Yaakov sent Malachim. Now there are two ways you can translate Malachim. Anybody know two ways? Angels is one. What's the other way? No. Messengers. Messengers. So the stone Chumash translate, and Yaakov sent angels. That's the Midrashic thing. So they interpret, so they share that whole thing. So I'm just giving you a sense. So it's one of his major accomplishments. So I want to now jump back to the Chumash. And so I made this connection just really right now. It is very interesting that two genius Bali Tshuva, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz and Rabbi Ari Kaplan, who grew up in very secular homes, who became, for all, you know, in their own reasons, become observant and use their, and both of them are also math science guys, which is also not really good literature, you would imagine, but I don't know how they do that also. I don't got all the answers here, guys. So we're able to crank out lots of stuff for the benefit of Jewish people, and specifically for people who do not have a Jewish education. Tremendous gift. Okay, so let's read Anna Bavakasha, read out Shmos Beis, the story of the birth of Moshe.
He entered the house of Bethuen and married Levi's daughter. The woman became pregnant and had a son. She realized how extraordinary the child was, and she kept hidden for 3 months.
Stop right there. How did she know that he was extraordinary? I mean, doesn't every mother think their child's extraordinary? Every Jewish, I think every mother, not just Jewish mother. No. I know, but I think it's a very common psychological phenomenon, and the Torah records many, many births, and it does not record that she realized how extraordinary the child was. So again, so you could say that on the flame shot is that she saw the child. She had other children. You'll see from later on the story, she had two older children. She had Miriam and she had Aaron, two older children. And their little baby Moshe is that you can also tell developmentally the kid is like, you know, moving through the Piaget stage of development rather rapidly over here, a little bit in comparatively. So she had other children she saw. This kid's like something's really amazing here. All right. The Midrash, of course, says that she saw that he was Tov. So he was Tov. So the whole room lit up, Midrashically, in other words. So, the Midrash is trying to say that it was discernible to her eye how extraordinary, amazing, developed this child was. All right, so she hid him because right now we're just context. Why does she hide basic Chumash? Why is Moshe's mom hiding little baby Moshe? Exactly correct. What's that? Hold on. Evan Rabin is somehow stuck up. Yes, that is weird. Evan, tell you are in the MP fellowship and you are late to class.
Like it's
he's locked outside.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. What? Okay, that's very nice of you. Okay.
When I came in, the room was weirdly open with the lock outside, and I just had to pull it in, so I guess someone closed the lock and
All right. So let's continue.
She no longer hide him. She took a pirate's box, coating it with asphalt and pitch, and she placed the child in it. She placed it in the rush of deer at the bank of the Nile. The child's sister stood herself at a distance to see what had happened to him.
Tell Scott, never mind. The guy just came.
Okay, hold on. Scott? Good. Good thing that the MG elevator is slow as molasses.
All right. Oh my God. Somebody says that like every shot.
Yes. Right. Okay, go on. So she could not only hide him, she put him in a pirate's box. Okay.
Went to bathe in the Nile while her maid walked along the Nile's edge. She saw the box in the rushes and sent Amata, her slave girl, to fetch it. Opening the box, she saw the boy. The infant began to cry and she had pity on it. It is one of the Hebrew boys, she said.
Okay. So here we have, and then as you know, the story continues on that the daughter who falls in love with little baby Moshe, and then. Pharaoh's daughter, the princess. And what does she do? She adopts him and she raises him. And so where is Moshe spending? Now, what happens next is that who comes to this is a little question on the Chumash here. Who comes to when Pharaoh's daughter comes and sees the baby and wants to take care of the baby? Who immediately comes right up to her and asks her a very important question? Miriam, Moshe's older sister. What does she say to him? What does she say to her? Would you be needing a nurse for this little young baby? She said, well, yes, I do. And she said, oh, you pay. Wonderful. And then, of course, she takes the little baby Moshe back home, but now under Egyptian authorization. And for the next couple of years, while little baby Moshe is becoming weaned, he's being raised by mom. Okay. But eventually, there was that sad day. The Torah does not report that sad day when Yocheved, Moshe's mom, had to hand over her son to Paro's daughter, this pagan princess.
Did it follow up with like Moses' mom's parents like later?
What do you mean?
Like when he's found out to be a Jew and has to like leave Egypt and come back.
Well, he didn't know, so fast forwarding, now just to get the basics, the storyline, he's raised in Paro's household.
Right.
And then when he kills the Egyptian and the word gets out that he murdered the Egyptian guard, Right. Then Paro wants to kill him. We discussed in other classes. Well, why did Paro want to kill him? Is it's his adopted grandson? How can he kill his own, want to kill his own adopted grandson? What? So, yes, he was always, as you're both saying, Paro was always suspicious and keeping an eye on this Paro, on this Moshe guy. Why? What was, you have to ask a basic question. How was Paro's daughter able to negotiate accepting a baby who Paro made a rule that they got to be killed? Welcome. What was that? Yes, and why would he agree to that? So, why would he agree to such a deal when he made a genocidal decree that all boys will be thrown into the river? What's age is what the key thing is, the age of the baby, and therefore what it basically she made the argument. The blank slate, I'll raise him as an Egyptian and basically he'll become an Egyptian. There won't be a problem. He will not be a Jew. So Tabula Rasa, he'll raise his boy. And then lo and behold, when Moshe grows up in the Paro's Paro's household, and at age, I don't know, 18, 25, goes out and actually slays the Egyptian guard to protect the Jewish person. And then that word gets out back to gets back to Paro. Why did he order his security people to go ahead and go after him and chase him, try to capture him and kill him? I mean, you're mentioning a midrashic point, but based upon pure pshat, on a basic reading of the storyline, why, from Paro's perspective, what he was doing made a lot of sense.
He represented Paro. Like,
okay.
You can't have someone representing Paro killing a guard. The other Jews will.
Well, one second. In the ancient world, do leaders kill their own people?
No.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
Maybe not directly. Yeah.
Okay, but still, let's say the case was simply. Let's case the situation was a little bit different. Let's say Moshe was just another prince in the palace, and got into a fight with another lowly Egyptian and killed him. Would he have been taken to justice for that? Yes, Scott. Yes, you are correct. What was significant? The fact that he protected the Jew from the Egyptian taskmaster beating him. Why was that? Why is that a critical piece of information in Paro ordering his forces against Moshe? Correct. Basically, Paro realized that Moshe essentially is a very dangerous person. He is an enemy of the state. Because basically, he was raised by Paro, trained with all the very best that Egypt had to offer, and he's using all that skills and all that information against the Egyptian empire. So now he has to be, he's an enemy of the state, and he has to be a fugitive that must be killed. Has to. If you're in Paro's perspective, you must kill this guy because he's a very dangerous figure. Because if he can, he'll become the rebel leader. He's a spy. He's going to cause a complete revolution. It's going to be a revolution. He's going to be the Lenin, the Trotsky, the Stalin. This guy's going to be taking everybody down. This guy's a dangerous figure. So from Paro's perspective, it makes a lot of sense that he has to kill Moshe. And Moshe actually, 50 years later, has to be told by God, you can go back to Egypt because those who want to kill you are now dead. So Moshe was concerned about him being captured by Egyptian authorities for over 50 years. 50 years he's running from the law. You don't think about Moshe as being a guy running from the law. He was running from the Egyptian authorities for over 50 years. And who was he turned into? We mentioned this in a different class, by a fellow Jew who blabbed on the story. The person who was protected, saved, shared the story, which then endangered him, and he got out, the moment he could. Very fortunate. Now, let's continue on. So, the question I have, and I've raised this question in years past, but I want to take it in a different direction. The question is very simple. Question 6: why deny Moshe the experience of being raised in his own natural family, the best home of the Jewish people, with Amram and Yocheved and Aaron and Moshe, and instead raise him with his adopted mom? Of all people, the princes of Egypt. So the greatest leader of the Jewish people, the greatest prophet, Moshe, was raised among pagans. Did not get a Jewish education. Why would that happen?
Well, it's inspired everyone. You know, if he could do it with like that, and you don't have this guy in the beginning, that way.
Well, okay, so that I think that's a takeaway, but does seem a little odd. So let's take a look at the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra has I think the right approach to this general point. Go ahead, Shoshana Bavakasha.
Rabbi Avraham both of Hashem are deep, and who can understand the foundational principles for various causes that Hashem uses? Perhaps Hashem...
Okay, stop right there. So basically, he's saying, to answer my question, is that really is, by definition, is a question that's unknowable. We can't know why. We can't put God into causality to know why God does anything. You understand that point? It's not something you can have clarity at all. You can guess, and that's what you're about to do. But he's saying that this is not something that's really natural. Let me explain why. Anything which happens in the natural order, every effect has a cause. And you can scientifically investigate that. And so ultimately, maybe not now, but in the future, it'll be known. But God is the beginning of the causal chain. He's the first cause. Therefore, you can't put a cause prior to him, so you can't know why he's doing anything. So it's impossible to know why God per se is doing something with absolute knowledge. Now you can go in, nevertheless, with a possibility. Yeah, perhaps.
Hashem caused Moshe to grow up in the royal palace in order that he should acquire a spirit of distinction and dignity through their training program and habits that would not suffer with a low spirit of one who is enslaved. You see that he killed the Egyptian because of his act of violence against the Jew, and he saved the daughters of Midian from the shepherds since they were acting aggressively and unjustly by having their sheep drink from the woman's drawn water.
Okay, so what C. Ibn Ezra says, what was the benefit of Moshe being placed and brought up as a child, as a baby, literally, and brought up in Paro's house? Yes?
Yeah, like more.
Not more free will.
He had a different perception of things in life because he was treated with dignity and respect.
So what did he? Doesn't say that. He what psychological malady did he avoid? Because exactly, the Jewish people. There's two aspects to slavery. There is the slavery of the body, where they do not control their schedule, what they get to do, and they have to work, and unfortunately, and with no pay. That's one aspect. That's what people all think of slavery. I don't get to do what I want, and I have to work, and I don't get paid for it. That's what people view. But that's one dimension of slavery. The other slavery is the slavery of the mind, which is necessary to control the person to be able to be the slave. Correct. Right. Well, how did the Jew? How long did it take the Jews to get out, to bust out of a slave mentality? Well, that's our death now. That's something now. But I'm saying back in the after the Jews left Egypt, did that generation ever get out of that slave mentality? No, they took the next their kids. Correct. Yes, a whole different situation. So Moshe was spared the crippling psychological burden of being in a slave nation under the thumb of the Egyptian Empire. And that allowed him to have the freedom, not of free will in a philosophical sense, but a freedom of will psychologically. In other words, he felt a sense of dignity, self-esteem, and the ability to act. And as identified, when he saw people being treated unjustly, people he had no relationship, like the women in Midian. He comes to the well, and there's Yitro's daughters are being beaten up, and their water being taken from them by these aggressive shepherds. And what does he do? He beats them up, and then he takes care of the women and gives them water. All right, and so therefore he's able. And when he saw the Jew being beaten, he intervenes and kills the Egyptian. So so that requires a freedom of spirit to do that. That's an interesting question. In other words, is it because, was his response to the injustice that he saw because he lived in a very highly curated, just environment in Paro's palace? So very sheltered, or was it as a function of his own personal sense of right and wrong, that when we see people being beaten, you have to step in. He felt compelled to step in. In other words, you think he wouldn't realize that by, if Moshe was only concerned about his own well-being, and he saw the Jew being beaten by the Egyptian taskmaster, what should he have done? Walk by. Nothing. Because if you're going to get involved, there's no upside for you. There's only downside for you. Well, that's what he didn't. We didn't do it. He looked to the left. He looked to the right. He saw nobody there. He thought he could get away with it, and lo and behold, he did not. Okay, go on. Let's do the Ralbach. Go. Wow, it's quite a long. We're fine.
They left the window open.
Yeah,
nice.
We're getting a little breezy. Yeah. We're getting a little breeze.
Oh, I don't need to put
the air conditioner on. All right. Okay. All right. Let's keep on going. Let's keep on going, Shoshana. You do finish it up. Yeah, the Rabbi.
The seventh lesson of Parshasha is one of the philosophical principles. This is from grasp of the power of the God's providence to his recipients of this providence. Hashem caused that the daughter of Pharaoh would find baby Moshe and would have compassion on him and to rescue him. This caused Moshe to be raised in the royal palace and learn from the wise men of Egypt. This was a cause in his education of science and advanced concepts which ultimately led Moshe to becoming a prophet. The ideas of the Egyptian elite, although incorrect, were instrumental in Moshe finding the truth. It also gave Moshe the confidence of an aristocrat, since he was spared the slavery humiliation that occurred to his brothers. This empowered him to stand before Paro and bring out the Jews from Egypt. This shows the nature of divine justice, as Paro wanted to do evil to thwart a future leader of the Jewish rebellion from arising. Hashem caused Paro to help grow, nurture, and develop Moshe into the future redeemer of the Jewish people.
Right. So in a similar way, what is the Ralbag's idea? What was the benefit to Moshe being raised in Paro's house? Confidence, agency, yes. And what else? More that, which is that's what he agrees with. He shares the same bite as the Ibn Ezra. What else did he get? What other? That's interesting. I never saw that before. That's an interesting idea. That's very good. It's interesting. Now the Ralbag is saying that was really that. The Ralbag is arguing that was natural to Paro's daughter. No, he's saying not. He's saying that she was a pawn, and she was being utilized to basically. Her natural compassion, because the truth is, like, you have to ask yourself a basic question. You have to put yourself into, if your father is the tyrant and dictator of Egypt, and he made a very clear rule that all Jewish baby boys must be drowned in the Nile, and you're going bathing and you see a baby boy, what would if you're the daughter of Paro, what would be the natural thing for you to do? At best. Or call over the security forces to take care of it. You're not going to do the deed yourself, but you're going to call somebody else to do that. Or I'll put it in more contemporary terms. Let's say Hitler had a daughter. Imagine Hitler had a daughter, and Hitler's daughter is in one of her summer homes, and she sees Jews hiding in a barn. Will she tell the Gestapo that there are Jews in the barn, or will she not tell the Jews they're hiding in the barn? She can tell them because she is committed to the ideology of her father, of the Third Reich. So why would you assume that Paro's daughter is not committed to the ideology of the Egyptian Empire? That's the normal thing. Not that she was going to become a party leader, but. When it says that the divine providence worked on her, means that she had a natural maternal pity, but then God utilized that and sort of like stimulated that even further, that she should sort of like have additional concern, and that should override her fear about getting into a fight or a conflict with her father. Actually, there are three. There, the midrash actually get three possibilities. I'm going to share with you. That's one possibility. Second possibility is that Paro's daughter went down to the Nile to do what? To go to the mikveh to be converted. All right. So now, yeah. So yeah. Okay, right. I know. I'll get your attention on that one. All right. So the midrash says that she's coming down to the water to bathe, but it's an act of going to the water to go to the mikveh to convert. Now, question is, obviously, that's not. Again, there's the plain stories that she and her attendants are going to bathe in the Nile because that's where the royalty did, and then the midrash says that she's going down to the river to bathe, go to the mikveh. What was the thing? So the basic idea is like this. The midrash is always trying to tell you the story written by the rabbis is giving you a story behind the story. And what they're trying to answer is, what was the mechanism of the divine providence with her to rescue Moshe from his destruction? So this implies that already her idea of conversion means it's a rejection of her prior community and a recommitting to a different community. Okay, so her going to the mikveh means that the reason why she wasn't going to kill baby Moshe is because she was rejecting the tyrannical genocidal position of her father. She was. This is like, for example, with Khrushchev, was the communist premier of Soviet Russia, and her daughter rebelled and became a capitalist. You have this phenomenon. In other words, recognize the errors of the ideology of the state and go in a different direction. According to that matters that she's converting. She wasn't technically converting because there was no conversion yet, because there were no Jews yet. But going to the river was sort of like her was part of her her deflection point of her transforming herself to being an ideologue and a follower of her father to a person who was rejecting her father. And seeing baby Moshe was a way for her to mount her rebellion. By taking little baby Moshe in, by adopting the Jewish baby, what greater repudiation of the Egyptian state and raising him on the Egyptian dime than taking little baby Moshe in? So that corner, that school of thought in the Midrash, that she comes in the conversion, that's that. I don't know. That's another midrash. Then there's a third one. Hold on. Let me give the third one. You're confusing that from that's from Hollywood. That's not in the midrash. Okay, but it's good. It's a good movie, but it's Hollywood. Okay, we continue. The third possibility is that she was coming to the mikveh because she was covered in tzaraat, that spiritual disease. And then what happens? She goes to the baby and she touches little Moshe and she gets cured. Okay, so hold on. Again, that's not it. All midrashim are not to be taken literally, but what is a literary device that's being articulated here is the question. So that means that the divine providence operated was it she viewed Moshe as being sort of like basically a magic baby, something very special about this child, and that it's going to be very good to me personally, physically, by me taking care of this child. The child has some sort of mojo or power to it, which God utilized her superstitious tendency and took advantage of that, and that's it. So there's three schools of thought of why did the daughter, because really she should have drowned him, but she, not only that, she rescued him and adopted him. So there seems to be just three schools of thought. So one possibility is that did God just take the natural maternal instinct and she just had profound pity? One thing is that Moshe became the object of her rebellion or repudiation of her father. Sort of this would be the feminist voice in the Midrash, or what? Okay, that's good. Yeah, but once you commit, you know, she had a commitment to the bitman. You know what I mean? So then, you know, she was going to throw the kid out once you get connected to it. It's like, maybe not. Okay, I'm not selling any one of these three schools of thought. I'm giving you three choices. You can take what you want. And then there's the idea of the tzaraat, which I think is a pshat that basically she viewed the child basically as like God utilized the sense of that she's the he's the magic baby, and that something's going to be very good for him. All right, now I want to conclude our class with taking these ideas of Rabbi Steinsaltz and Moshe Rabbeinu and to apply it to practical elements here. So scenario number one, Steve MGR is a therapist. When he sits down with his Wednesday night chavrusa and he learns the Parsha, how would Rabbi Steinsaltz advise him to bring in his expertise to his learning?
Think of this study time as something where you should totally remove yourself from everything else you do in your life, or just use your knowledge of people, etc., to apply it to Parsha.
1,000% correct. Bring your wisdom and your study and all your bring your life learning, bring your study, bring your expertise to the Parsha. That's your asset. Not the fact that you didn't go to years of yeshiva. That's not a, don't view that as a liability. You have assets. Bring your assets. Many people feel very, no, you have a merging. That's really the idea of a modern orthodoxy is that God's wisdom is essentially one. Both his wisdom, his revealed wisdom, and the wisdom of the world, of math, science, all the different disciplines can exist harmoniously. So, well said. All right, scenario two. Nancy MGR currently lives in a modern Orthodox community in northern New Jersey. She misses the warmth and enthusiasm of MJE. What would Rabbi Steinsaltz advise her to do? Stop complaining.
Your suggestion to the new community.
Right. No, don't sit there. I'm going to take Daffy's point and Anna's point, put them together. Stop kvetching. Stop complaining, stop whining, and basically say there are certain things that I experienced in my time at MG, which I think this community would benefit greatly from. And let me see what I can do. Maybe you should start a more, I'll tell you what other, this is not just other, what MGers have done. In many communities, they have actually started beginner services where they themselves went through the process. They create a service. I think of one. Atlantic Beach has been going on for 20, maybe 15 years for people who are not comfortable with the service, who did not get any Jewish education. They can come to the service. It started by and maintained for the last 15 years by an MGer because they felt this is missing in our community and I can complain about it. I can nudge the rabbi about to do it, or I could do it. You could, in order, the bottom line is Rabbi Steinsaltz did not complain. Well, how come there isn't a Steinsaltz in English for me? Why isn't there a Tanakh well-written for me? Why isn't there, as an Israeli, the easy-to-understand commentary on the Torah Mishnah Torah available to me? No. He wrote it. Okay? Now, not everybody. So that's a uber type A personality, super genius, 1 in 1,000-year kind of response. But taking that down a couple of notches down, maybe a lot, there's what you can do. You have experiences. You have bring your experiences to bear. Last scenario, Stan MGR never went to yeshiva. His friends remarked that he always has interesting questions that they never thought of. Based on the unique life of Rabbi Steinsaltz, why do you think this is? Okay, true, but unpack that more. There's more animals in it. Yes, therefore what?
From a secular life, actually, you have other perspectives.
Yes.
More open.
Yes. That's it. So when you are, when a person grows up in the Orthodox community, there's a plus, isn't it? Like everything else, life is a series of trade-offs. You create a worldview and certain thoughts about certain things. So in certain sense, that's helpful. And in certain sense, that's not helpful because it blocks you from seeing certain questions or inconsistencies. And therefore, you as a growing intellectual person is limited. And that is why, for this reason, I've enjoyed every single year, every single month, and every single week I've been at MG for the last 15 years, is because learning with people who do not grow up, quote unquote, in the bubble, I always get great questions. Every class, I've not been disappointed, not even once. Always a new, fresh idea. And it's not just for me that should appreciate, but everybody. In fact, one of the things that when people who are in the fellowship, in the senior fellowship, what do they gain the most? It's not so much, they like the classes, and they like the rabbis, yeah, great, of course. But the questions that other people bring to the class or ideas that other people suggest in the class, it might be something that I was thinking about, but I couldn't quite verbalize, but my friend next to me was able to articulate that. As Chazal say, the rabbis say the following phrase, Harbe limati marbosai. I have learned much from my teachers. Yoser mechavarai, but even more from my colleagues. Umi talmidai, but from my students, yos mikulam, I've learned the most. So level two, your rabbis will teach you a lot, but there's a limit. From your chavrusas, from your colleagues, from your classmates, you'll learn even more because they're in a similar wavelength, and then they'll ask things that maybe in the outer reaches of your consciousness, you sort of felt or something, but you couldn't articulate it, and they'll verbalize it. You can gain a lot. You gain tremendous amount by just listening to others and engaging others and having conversations and out of class conversations. Those are money. So and then God willing, at the right time, then you will have your own students. You'll pass it on. Reich Steinzel did it, and you'll do it. And that could be children, it could be relatives, it could be friends, it could be all people. All these are going to be people, potential students that you have an impact to share. All the wisdom that you have, to share it to somebody else. And that's the gift that we as a Jewish people believe of keep on giving. One generation gives to the next generation, and we impact everybody we can. That's really the idea. And Rabbi Steinzel, I think, which I wanted to introduce you to tonight, really is an amazing person who on so many levels is an inspiration to all people, but certainly a person who grew up secular till, I don't know, 15, 17 years old, whatever it was, his personal story, and he accomplished such a great things. Thank you so much, everybody. Welcome. Thank you. Coming. Oh, no.